Okay. So, welcome everyone. And today's talk or sutta is going to be a sutta from the Nidana Sanyutta. The Nidana means something like source or cause. So this is the Sanyutta, the connected discourses on causality, on causes. And that Sanyutta is all about suttas on dependent originations. This is all about dependent originations, so it would be a bit like some of the other things that I've been talking about here recently. This particular sutta was suggested to me by somebody from overseas who wanted to have a look at this. So sometimes take things from there. One of the nice things about this particular sutta is that it is almost like a practical application of dependent origination, how it actually, you know, how we can work with it looking at it, looking at ourselves, looking at our life, looking at how we relate to things in the world, and then how that then gives rise to dependent origination in a practical way. So this is kind of the nice thing about this. Often it becomes very theoretical, but this is more kind of hands-on, if you like, which is good. It's good to have these hands-on suttas. So let's see how this goes. Nidana Sanyutta 66 is called Exploration. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling among the Kurus, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kamasa Dhamma. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus, the monks. Thus, monks, Venerable Sir, those monks replied, and the Blessed One said this. So the Kurus, they are in the area northwest of where the Buddha usually lived, so towards like Delhi, New Delhi area, where Delhi is now. And this is one of the kind of the original countries where the Aryans went to when they came into India. That's where they started, it's kind of started out. So it's interesting. This is probably as far west as the Buddha would have gone pretty much on his travels. And quite a few suttas, which are often considered, sometimes considered important, were spoken in this place, like the Satipatthana Sutta and many others as well. And then the Blessed One said this: do you engage in inward exploration, bhikkhus? When this was said, one monk said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, I engage in inward exploration. How do you engage in inward exploration, monk? The monk then explained, but the way he explained did not satisfy the Blessed One. Then the Venerable Ananda said, now is the time for this Blessed One. Now is the time for this Fortunate One. Let the Blessed One explain inward exploration. Having heard it from the Blessed One, the monks will remember it. So how do you explore your mind? How do you explore your experiences in the appropriate fashion so as to make some progress in your understanding of the Dhamma, of nature, so to speak? Then listen and attend closely, Ananda. I will speak. Yes, Venerable Sir, the bhikkhus replied. It's interesting how the Buddha always says this, or very often says this at the beginning of his discourses. He says, listen and attend closely. Right? Basically reminding the monks or the lay people or the nuns or whoever is present that what is going to come now is important, right? This matters. This is something, like, deliver these teachings for you out of compassion for you, because I understand that you want to find a solution to the problems of life. So listen to it. This is for your benefit. And he often says that, and obviously it obviously has some effect, right? Otherwise he wouldn't say this. So it's good to keep these things in mind, I suppose. The Blessed One said this: here, because when engaged in inward exploration, a monk explores thus. The many diverse kinds of suffering that arise in the world, headed by old age and death, what is the source of this suffering? What is the origin? From what is it born and produced? When what exists, does aging and old age and death come to be? When what does not exist, does old age and death not come to be? As he explores, he understands thus the many diverse kinds of suffering that arise in the world, headed by old age and death. This suffering has acquisition as its source, acquisition as its origin. It is born and produced from acquisition. When there is acquisition, old age and death come to be. When there is no acquisition, old age and death do not come to be. He understands old age and death, its origin, its cessation, and the way leading on that is in conformity with its cessation. He practices in that way and conducts himself accordingly. This is called a monk who is practicing for the utterly complying, for the cessation of old age and death. So here you can see that we are, you can gather from this in the sense that we are coming to something like dependent origination, because we are talking about old age and death and suffering, which of course is the end point of the series of 12 links that you find in dependent origination. So this is the problem in life, right? The problem in life is the suffering. Yeah? And very often the kind of the suffering that is immediately obvious to us, one of the most important ones obviously is death. The fact that all of this is going to come to an end one day. This is the most powerful type of suffering because it challenges so many of our attachments in the world. Right? So many of the things I get challenged by death, so much more than just the external possessions, but many of our identifications, who we are as beings, is also related to this world, our status, our relationships with other people, etc. Our sense of self, or who we are, is very caught up in how we relate to things in this world. So because of that, it is the big deal in the world, and very often people are very reluctant to talk about the idea of death. They're very worried about that. And the interesting thing then, of course, if death is such a big problem because it challenges our attachments, then the source of the cause here that the Buddha explained, the being the cause of all this suffering and aging, old age and death, is precisely acquisition, right? Acquisition is exactly those things that we own in the world. So it challenges all of those things that we own, that the ownership is the problem, really. One way of translating this word called here is translated as acquisition. The Pali word is upadi. Upadi can I like to translate it. It's not a literal translation, but it's a translation which captures the meaning, is the idea of ownership. Once you own something, then that is always going to be challenged by those big changes which will challenge that ownership and will show that actually there wasn't a real ownership there in the first place. You're just borrowing these terms. You have them temporarily, and then you have to give them up. So this word upadi is interesting here. This word occurs in the suttas, and the person who asked this question asked me specifically, how does it relate to the usage of the same sutta, of another sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 26. Majjhima Nikaya 26 is the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Noble Search, and it's all about the life of the Buddha. The Buddha tells his life story, how he is living the home life. And then one day he realizes that all of these things that he's owning in this life, all of these things, and he kind of enumerates the things, these are all called upadis, cattle, the horses, and all the animals that they own, their houses, wife and children are included in that, right? Everything in this world that you are kind of acquisitions in a sense, that things that you have some degree of ownership towards. Here, ownership just means a psychological ownership. So when I say owning the wife and children, I don't necessarily mean literally owning them in a legal sense, but the sense that they are yours in a personal sense. So it would be the same thing for a wife owning the husband, right? It's a psychological state of mind, really. Yeah. So you have all these things, and the Buddha reflects, well, all of these things in the world, all of these things that I own, all these acquisitions that I have made over a long period of life, they too are subject to death, he says there. They too are subject to old age, to disappearing, to defilements, to exactly the same problems that I have. Right? So here I go out in the world and I grasp onto all this other stuff, all this stuff in the world, which itself is subject to all the same problems that I experience in my own life. And this is how he distinguishes what he calls the noble search from the ignoble search. The ignoble search is precisely the searching for things that can never give any lasting satisfaction, because they will always be challenged by the laws of impermanence. One day it will be ripped away from you. You have no choice in the matter. And then he thinks, why am I searching for all this stuff? It's difficult enough already. I am subject to all of these things, and I'm just compounding the problem by searching for more of this. This is crazy. And then he goes down the road of the noble search, where he's searching instead for the end of these things, the end of aging and death, the end of the problem. And this is how this relates to these things in the Noble Search Sutta. So the word upadi means all of the things that we feel in the world, that we own, right? All the things that we have acquired, and all your possessions, all the relationships you have, all of these things. But in fact, in this sutta, it is even broader than that. Because what upadi also means, of course, is also the acquiring of who you are as a person. The five khandas, the five aggregates, the five things, the five aspects of personality. That, I think, is quite a nice translation maybe for khanda, the five aspects of personality. The five, you know, all these things inside of us that we hold on to, that we take to be ourself. So, and the five aspects of personality are just, you know, all of those things that you identify with in your mind and your position, right? You are attached to that. You feel a sense of ownership. This is my body. You always talk about my body. These are my thoughts. These are my perceptions. These are my feelings. This is my will. This is my awareness, right? And so all of these things too have been acquired. We hold on to them. And they too, of course, are challenged by the process of impermanence. So the point here is that as long as we have this sense of ownership, then there will be suffering as a consequence. Not only suffering, but also old age and death. So why is that the case? Well, obviously, right, if you own all this stuff and it is challenged, and the ownership is challenged by impermanence, then of course it leads to suffering. Ownership always leads to suffering. It's always challenged by impermanence. Says, sorry, you think you own this? Well, I've got bad news for you. I'm going to, you know, take it out of your grasp. You think you're holding on? Actually, you can't hold on to these things. So that's obvious. It's quite obvious why it must lead to suffering. But how does it lead to old age and death? What is the connection between ownership and death, for example? Even if you stop owning things, you will still have to die, right? So what is the connection there? And in this case, what you have to remember is that this is only an extract from dependent origination. The full dependent origination, after ownership, you have there is a birth, right? And then there is old age and death. So there is the assumption here is that you also continue on into future lives. And this is how this upadi, the ownership, must lead to old age and death. Not just in this life, but also in future lives. Only in this context does it actually make sense what is being said here. So it leads on in samsara. It continues the wheel of samsara. That is the problem with ownership. Whenever you feel you own something, you're going to keep on revolving round and round and round, being reborn, dying, etc., again and again and again into the future. And this is what this is pointing to here. And this is a very good example of a very nice teaching. I remember Ajahn Brahm told me this a long time ago. When he went to Sri Lanka, I think it was in 1993 or 92 perhaps, when he first trip Ajahn Brahm had to Sri Lanka. And when he was there, he went to visit some of the very interesting monasteries and teachers who were available. Of course, some of the Western teachers, because some of those Western teachers were becoming known in the West. And one of these was the scholar monk Venerable Jnanaponika, who lived in the forest hermitage in Kandy, up in the mountains there. It's a very nice place. I've been there myself. It's a very beautiful little place. That's where the BPS, the Buddhist Publication Society, is based. And they have published a lot of the very nice and important books on Buddhism for the Buddhist world to enjoy, especially the Theravada world. But when he was there, it was Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi was there, Venerable Nalaponika was there, and they were discussing the suttas, and they were discussing some of the difficult passages, right? And this passage here is a little bit unusual. Why is it? Why does it go straight from ownership to old age and death? What's the reason for that? There's a jump. Birth seems to be missing, right? This is the sort of passage you might argue, well, once you give up all ownership, you have given up death. It means you're not going to die anymore. So, you know, that's what it looks like, right? Death is given up once you give up ownership. But, of course, once you see the bigger picture of dependent arising, then you know that there are links in between. And what Venerable Annapurna said is that if there are suttas that are unusual, that have a different meaning, that don't fit the normal system of things, right? Things which are perhaps difficult to interpret, you don't know exactly what it is like. And very often they will be individual suttas, right? If there is an individual sutta like that, you should never take your stand as a Buddhist, take your stand, take your doctrine, large number of suttas, which it is. And this is a very sound piece of advice, because very often we love those little suttas. Well, I know this as a monastic, right? If something is unusual and different from normal, it's very fertile ground for discussion. And usually discussions get completely forget to ground those different suttas in that large number of suttas which have the same message again and again, which are very clear throughout. So this is very useful in this particular situation right here. Ground this, understand this in terms of all the suttas that actually show dependent arising in the form of 12 links. And then you get the wrong. It's very useful to listen to some of these ancient monks, right? I think he was very ancient, Ajahn Brahm. He was already probably way up in his 80s when Ajahn Brahm met him in those days. And sometimes they have a lot of experience, and your views about the Dhamma get well rounded and usually well rounded and well balanced, having lived the monastic life and thought about Buddhism for so long. Yeah. So this is how we should do that. So birth comes in between there, right? So what is going on here? What is going on here is that when you have the ownership of something, right, that means that you have this idea in your mind that you're going to be enjoying this in the future. This is what ownership is about. If you have no idea of enjoying things in the future, it's not really ownership anymore. It's like you have let go of it. If you have no sense, if you feel you own a house, it means that I want to enjoy this house in the future. If I own these robes, I will be enjoying them in the future as well as now. And whatever you feel you own is things that your mind is preoccupied about. So there is a degree of craving there, a degree of attachment, a degree of purpose and aim about the future, right? And this is one of the aspects that always propels you into a rebirth, because you are looking to the future, you have craving about it, so you are projecting yourself into the future, seeing yourself in the future in a certain way. And this is how craving always gives rise to rebirth, the idea of projecting yourself into a future life or whatever it is. So this is the first way, right? This is the way that ownership must give rise to future birth, and therefore also the continuation of the round and death and old age and all of these kind of things. And the other way is that your ownership, depending on what you have, it determines the, if you like, the level or the quality of your consciousness, of your mind. Right? So if you own sensual objects, right, you own all these wonderful things in the world, a nice house, all these wonderful possessions, you have a nice partner in life and you enjoy all sorts of entertainment and whatever it is, your ownership is mostly in the sensual world. So that is what you crave for, that's what you desire. Your mind is like stationed at that level, right? But then you start to meditate, right, and you get a different view of the world. You start to realize, actually, there's more happiness to be had here. So you shift that level of the mind. It goes up, the quality of the mind changes. And you are now, your mind is at the level of perhaps, you know, if you go really deep in the meditation, the better the meditation is, the higher, in a sense, the level of mind is. So this is the other shape. Right? You own things in the world, or you own these feelings that come in meditation practice. So you crave for that. You want to meditate more because you had some nice experiences, and that's where you find your happiness. So that becomes your level of the mind, and then because that's the level of the mind in this life, that's where it continues on when you pass away and you die. This is the two ways in which your present ownership or your present craving drives the rebirth in the future. Through the aims and intentions of the mind, what you're aiming at, and through the level and quality of your consciousness. So this is how this works. So this is how to understand this. And this is something very practical, because you can feel this within yourself. You can feel largely where your consciousness is at. What are the things in the world? Where are the places that you find happiness? What are the places you think about or fantasize about? When you kind of come back and what is your kind of the general direction of your mind, the purpose and aim of your mind? And that general direction and purpose of the mind, that is the level of your consciousness. That is where you are at in your life. And you can feel that. You can experience that directly. So it is quite useful. And then you have some idea where you are likely to be heading also in the future, right? Gives you a rough idea what's going on there. So this sutta is more experiential than the normal understandings of dependent origination. So he understands how these many, you can see here how this is then phrased in terms of the Four Noble Truths, right? You understand old age and death. You understand its origin, its cessation, and the way leading to the cessation. So you understand old age and death. This means, of course, the reason why he says understands this, because you have a good understanding, and there's a full understanding of this. You have an idea of the wheel of rebirth, right? Of continued life into the future. And so it is a profound understanding of these things. And then you see these things. You see its origin coming from the previous one. This is why dependent arising is always about finding the origins of things, right? You have the 12 links, one thing leading to another. It's all about how things originate. Take away the origin of something, then you have the cessation, and then you have the path leading to that cessation as well, which then, of course, always is the Noble Eightfold Path. And all of these things are understood together. This is part of the way that the Dhamma is understood. So, and then you practice in this way, and then this is called the bhikkhu, who is practicing for the utterly complete destruction of suffering, for the cessation of old age and death. So I hope that makes sense to you, at least to some degree. This is quite fascinating. It is actually quite practical in a certain way, because there's a lot of self-knowledge that is required. If once you have that self-knowledge, you know your mind, the fluctuations of your mind, where you tend to stand, where you tend to find your happiness, you have some idea what's going on here. Anyway, let's move on to the next step of this. Then, engaging further in inward exploration, he explores thus: what is the source of this ownership or acquisition? What is its origin? From what is it produced and born? When what exists, does acquisition come to be? And when what is absent, does acquisition not come to be? As he explores and understands thus, an ownership has craving as its source, craving as its origin. It is born and produced from craving. When there is craving, acquisition comes to be. When there is no craving, acquisition does not come to be. He understands acquisition, ownership, its source, its origin, its cessation, and the way leading on that is in conformity with its cessation. He prays and conducts himself accordingly. This is called a bhikkhu, who is practicing for the utterly complete destruction of suffering, for the cessation of acquisition. So, why do we acquire things in the world? Why do we have ownership? Why do we have this sense that we should be in control of all of these things in the world? Well, obviously craving, right? It's fairly obvious. If you crave for things, if you have desires, you want to be able to control that craving, you want to be able to satisfy it. One of the most obvious ways of being able to satisfy craving is to own stuff, right? If you have a house, you have a nice place you can go to where you can kind of get a good night's sleep and you can enjoy your entertainment, or you can have a nice meditation room where you can meditate and all this kind of stuff. It means you have a bit more control over your life. If you don't have a house, it's a bit rough. That's why we feel sorry for all the people living on the street, right? It's not very nice to have to live on the street. This is part and parcel of what it means to attach to things. Craving gives rise to all of these things. So you crave, that's why you get into partnership, right? That's why you get you get married, or you have relationships. It's exactly the same idea again. There is all of these things kind of revolve around the same thing. Yeah. So ownership, I think, is very fairly obvious what is going on there. That craving and ownership go hand in hand. This is related to when you look at the ordinary way of dependent arising. Normally you have craving, which is tanha pachaya upadana, right? Tanha is the cause for upadana. Upadana means like taking things up. Taking things up is very similar to the idea of ownership. You take something up, becoming a Buddhist, right? You take up certain views, you take up living in a house. This is very, very similar to the idea of ownership. So upadana can be translated as taking up or attachment or clinging, etc. And of course, part of the things that we take up, which I didn't mention before, is not only all the material phenomena and also meditation practice, but it also includes such things as views, right? I'm a Buddhist. Buddhism is great. Buddhism is good. And hopefully that's true, because otherwise it's bad news, but it's still a view, right? Until you have it really clarified for yourself that actually it really is good. And it actually takes a lot of insight to see that fully. Hopefully we're all on the right track. So these views too, we're owners really of our views, right? These are things that is part and parcel of our identity, who we are, who we take ourselves to be here. Okay, as usual, if you want to ask any questions as we go along, please feel free to do so here. Okay, then, having understood the cause of acquisition or the cause of ownership is craving, he goes on to the next one here. Then, engaging in further inward exploration, he explores thus, when this craving arises, where does it arise? When it settles down, upon what does it settle? As he explores, he understands thus, whatever in the world has a pleasant and agreeable nature, it is here that this craving arises when it arises, it is here that it settles when it settles down. And what in the world has a pleasant and agreeable nature? The I has a pleasant and agreeable nature in the world. It is here that this craving arises when it arises. It is here that it settles when it settles down. So too the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind have a pleasant and agreeable nature. It is here that this craving arises when it arises. It is here that it settles down when it settles down. So craving arises depending on the agreeable things in the world. Right? Again, very obvious. We can see this happening in ourselves all the time. Where are your cravings and what do they relate to? For some of you, maybe they relate to meditation practice. Some of you may probably have some nice meditation experiences. And then the craving comes for that, right? And then because you get craving for that, it doesn't come back again. Craving stops you, hinders you from getting that meditation experience back. Craving becomes the problem in those kind of situations. We always crave for those things that we think are going to give us happiness in life. And I think it's very, very obvious that that is the case. But normally when we're talking about the agreeable and pleasant things in life, we're talking about individual things, right? I like chocolate ice cream, or I like this kind of movies, or I like, whatever it is. But here they actually talk about the actual senses themselves as the areas of craving. And it makes fairly good sense, because it is the senses that give you access to that world. You know, you see something beautiful. You know, I sit now and I look outside. It's actually quite beautiful out there. You know, you see the park and you see all the trees outside. And it is that, the eye, which gives you access to all those beautiful sights. And because of that, you get attached to the eye. The eye itself is regarded as agreeable because it gives you access to all those agreeable things. Visual experience always comes through the eye. So the eye, therefore, is agreeable. The eye itself is not really agreeable. It's kind of neutral, right? If you, the eye is just there. I don't know if it makes any difference in itself. But the experience that you acquire, of course, is important. And that's why you attach to the eye, right? As a consequence of that. So the eye is important. And the same thing with the other five senses, including the mind being the large one. That's where you get those meditation experiences through, mediated through the mind. And of course, those six sense bases is everything here. There isn't anything apart from that. So when the Buddha here says that craving arises in regard to these six sense bases, the whole world is included. Everything is included in that. Nothing is left out. So if you understand that entire world of the six sense bases, and you understand that there's nothing there really that should be craved for, that only then does really craving stop. Another small point here is that this sutta, it talks about craving only in terms of the positive feelings, right? In terms of what is agreeable and what is pleasant in the world. And of course, that is where most of the craving arises, and arises in terms of those things that we want. And these are the things which have a sense of meaning, that we're pursuing the pleasant stuff. And this is what really, in the end, is the most important aspect of craving. But craving can also arise in terms of the unpleasant things. We want to get rid of the unpleasant things. So it can also, that can also be part of it. It's not mentioned here because that doesn't really drive your life so much. Life is more driven by searching for the pleasant. So if you have something unpleasant, for example, often it means that you move towards what you think is nice instead. You're feeling a bit depressed, and because you're feeling depressed, you go and have something nice to eat or something like that. It doesn't really get rid of the depression. It's just a little band-aid on the at that time. If you feel depressed, what should I do? You should rather do something which lifts up the mind, right? And something which is more powerful, has more spiritual uplift, like doing something nice, doing something kind, doing an act of charity somewhere. And I remember there was some research done on that, which I read about many years ago, that actually said that some people do that. That when they feel down, they feel depressed, they actually, their strategy to overcome that is to go out and do some act of charity, an act of kindness somewhere. There's a lot of wisdom there already. People have really understood where real happiness is to be found. The vast majority of people haven't understood that, and they just go and have a nice ice cream or something, and it makes them more depressed afterwards, because then they get a bit fat as well at the same time, and it's really kind of has a bad kind of double effect. Anyway, so that is how dependent origination is expressed in this particular sutta. That's really all there is to it, right? It's very interesting here, this very short and simple explanation of dependent arising, dependent origination. Just starting off with the pleasant things in the world, and how if you grasp those pleasant things in the world in the wrong way, how it leads to the suffering, old age and death in the future. Right? It's a very simple, quite a simple presentation here. Much more simple, much more practical, much more easy to understand how you can relate that to your own experience than the ordinary 12 steps of dependent arising here. So what is it then? What is the root reason why we grasp that and why we see all these things in the world as pleasant? And whenever we see the pleasant and agreeable nature in these things, craving arises. What's going on there? Why does this happen in the first place? And of course, this is where you go back to the first steps in dependent origination, going back all the way back to avijja. Avijja being this word in Pali which means not understanding things properly, not really seeing what's going on, having a wrong view about things, not understanding things according to reality, right? Avijja is the root source of all of this. When we misunderstand the nature of reality, Basically, what it means is that is when we see things in the world in agreeable, in such a way that we pursue them, we go after them, we crave for them, we get ownership for these things. So this is the root problem, is a misunderstanding of the nature of reality. And that misunderstanding of the nature of reality is basically, it is two things, and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago here as well, but it is two things in particular. And one is the idea that you know, so you go out and you pursue, I know where it is, so because you know where it is, you go out and pursue it. It makes very good sense, it's natural. We don't have much choice in the matter. If you think you know where happiness is going to be, then you're going to go pursue it. You're going to go out and get yourself into a nice relationship. You're going to kind of build up all these things in the world. And then you pursue all that. You do that. Instead of getting happiness, you end up getting suffering. That's what he's saying here. It's a very stark contrast. We think that we're pursuing happiness, when in fact, what we are pursuing is actually suffering here. Why? Because every time you attach, every time you own something, you will have to be separated from that. It will have to be torn away from you by the nature of reality, by impermanence, anicca, and then you will suffer as a consequence. So this is the problem. We see happiness where there actually probably isn't that much happiness. And then there may be some happiness, but there's also a massive downside to those things. And then when you start to see things in the right way, then you don't look upon those things in the world anymore as agreeable and pleasant in the same way. You withdraw your interest from that. And because your interest is withdrawn from those things, it means that craving doesn't arise there anymore in the same way. So it is our misunderstanding, right? And you will note that this avidya, this ignorance, has many different levels and degrees to it. In the very coarse manifestations of avidya, it is this incredible indulgence in the sensual pleasures in the world, right? Whatever that may be. But then, as you start perhaps developing a spiritual path, you start to see that there actually isn't that much happiness, because there's always craving always there, lack of contentment, lack of happiness, lack of satisfaction. And then you move into the area of meditation and you start to understand the happiness that comes from contentment and peace inside, and the joy and things that can come from that. So your avidya, your ignorance, is actually changing. You have a new degree of ignorance. There's still some ignorance there, but your craving is now in a different area of life. It has to do with perhaps the mental states rather than all the things in the world. So avidya changes. And this is one of the things you can see again in your own life, how the things that are interesting in life actually change gradually over the years, over the decades. Right? I have seen that. I can see that very, very clearly in myself. I've been a monk for 20 years now. If I go back even further and look at all those last 30 years or whatever, even longer, you can see the change in where you are finding happiness in life, where you're finding satisfaction. And this is a diminishing of avidya. Avidya is going down. You have less hindrances. When you have less hindrances, there's less misunderstanding, delusion, and avidya. And then you are finding happiness in a place where actually there is at least a little bit of happiness, right? The happiness of meditation is more true, it's more real than the happiness of the sense world. It's more immediate, it's more in the present moment. It's not always in the future, not always connected with craving. So it's better, but you're still searching for happiness in the world. And eventually, of course, with the elimination of avidya, the elimination of delusion, one day you realize that actually it is this whole idea of existence in the world, this whole idea of being reborn, that is the problem. And then you don't have interest in any of those things anymore. You're not searching for happiness in the world anymore. If you know that rebirth is the problem, you're not going to search for any happiness in the world of existence. And then craving stops, because you are no longer projecting yourself into the future. You're not interested in a future. The future becomes irrelevant. You don't want to move on into the future anymore. So once you understand that there is no happiness in the world of experience, you all craving must stop as a consequence. And that is what happens here. You don't find those agreeable and delightful things in the world anymore. So this is one side of this delusion thing, right? This the sense that we know where happiness is, but not actually really understanding what is going on. And a very important corrective to that is things like the idea of rebirth is a very important corrective to that. And this is why the Buddha, on his night of awakening, he remembers his past lives, right? And that is kind of the spur that drives him, enables him to then give up everything, basically, as a consequence. And especially to see through the idea of the self, which is one of the most difficult things to see through. This is one side of this avijja, this idea that we know where happiness is. So ask yourself, sometimes, be careful with that and ask yourself, well, how much do I actually know about this? The world often is very different from what we think it is. And the other aspect of avijja is the sense of that we are the agent in our life. We are the chooser. We are the ones in charge. We can choose to go this way or that way. And we can, as a consequence, we can manufacture our happiness and we can avoid the suffering in life. But this is another problem, right? Because this sense of agency, again, is something that reinforces the idea that I want to go out, if you like, into the world, or I want to control experience in one way or another, because you feel that you can control things. You don't really understand that lies behind choice. You choose because of cause and conditions. You don't choose because you are some kind of independent entity which stands outside of the stream of experience. You don't stand outside the stream of experience to make choices. You are within that stream of experience. You are caused and conditioned into what you are now. Your choices are all caused and conditioned. It feels like you are making independent choices, but actually the independency of your choices is very, very, very limited, if there is anything at all. This is the other thing which is good to reflect on, right? That you are a product of all of these things. It means that you understand the limits of your own ability. You don't really control things. Rather, your will is just a pre-programmed robotic mechanism which just does its things according to all these causes and conditions. And when you see that, it kind of gives you a little bit less interest in trying to make the right choices in your life, etc. So this is where it all comes from. And when you do that, you start to no longer find that interest. You don't no longer see things as agreeable and pleasing in the same way. And you actually become interested in calming down the will, calming down the choice. If choice can't give you any happiness, if you go around choosing in the world doesn't really get you anywhere, then calming down the will and becoming peaceful in meditation starts to become a very beautiful proposition as a consequence. So, then the Buddha says, because whatever ascetics and Brahmins in the past regarded that in the world with a pleasant and agreeable nature, as permanent, as happiness, as self, as healthy, as secure, they nurtured craving. In nurturing craving, they nurtured acquisition, ownership. In nurturing acquisition, they nurtured suffering. In nurturing suffering, they were not freed from birth, old age, death. They were not freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. They were not freed from suffering, I say. Right? So, whatever ascetics and Brahmins in the past, ascetics and Brahmins, samana, brahmanas, the idea here is that if you are a real a Brahmin is the highest caste those days in India, but it was, they were the priesthood or whatever. But to be a real priest or a real ascetic, somebody has really practiced the spiritual life in the right way, meant that you had actually found a solution to the problems in the world, right? So a real Brahmin would be somebody who had actually understood this process and had abandoned suffering as a consequence. This is how the Buddha takes on the ideas that existed in India at the time, right? The Brahmin idea, the hereditary priesthood that existed. Well, he says, well, actually, you don't become a Brahmin by birth. You become a Brahmin through your practice, through how you see the world. So it takes that world and gives it a new meaning. And this is how the Buddha often works with language, the language that was available at that time. So he kind of changes the meaning. And the same thing, of course, with the Samanas. There were lots of ascetics walking around India and not really getting anywhere in the practice. But the real ascetic, the Aryas, the noble ones from Buddhist point of view, these are the ones who look at the world in this way. And here you see this idea I was talking about ignorance, right? It is mentioned right here. It is this regarding those things in the world that have a pleasant and agreeable nature. You regard them as nitya, permanent, nitya, reliable, right? They are reliable. They are there are things that you can that are available for you if you want them. You forget that they actually are impermanent, that they're going to be taken away from you. And this is one of those. So this is one of those core things. We need to remind ourselves all the time that these things are unreliable. They're uncertain. We don't know what's going to happen to them. We don't know if they will be taken away from us, because we tend to forget that. And this is one of the problems in life. We lose that perspective, and you have to remind yourself over and over again to keep that perspective in mind. And these other things, their happiness, right? This is, of course, related to the idea of permanence. If you can control something, it is a source of happiness for you. It is something that you can rely on. It's a reliable source of happiness. If it is impermanent, of course, it's not going to be that. It is a self, again, very related to the same idea, because the things that you can control, the things that you can rely on, are precisely those things that the self, either it is the self or it is owned by the self. The self can control that. Again, it's the idea that we are the controller in the world. There are certain things that we are in charge of, especially those things that we think we own. That's what ownership implies, right? It implies being in charge of things, being in control of things. And the Buddha says it's actually not, that actually doesn't happen here. It is healthy and secure, right? These are just other ways of looking at these ideas. Secure, right? Something you can rely on, you can relax, and you feel good about it. Health, right? Being health is the highest gain, as it says somewhere here. You want to have healthy. So when you look at those things in this way, and this is exactly what avidya is all about, ignorance, delusion, lack of understanding, when you do look at them that way, then you nurture acquisition, because then acquisition makes sense. Right? If you can control things in life, if you are in charge, if things are can give you a reliable sense of happiness, then of course you have to acquire those things. It makes perfect sense. It's a perfect logical thing here. So again, the only way you can get out of that is to try to remind yourself that maybe this isn't quite so. And once you start to get into the Buddhist framework, I think it's very obvious that these things aren't the way they kind of the way we normally think of them. And of course, when you nurture that, when you nurture it, and when you nurture acquisition, you nurture suffering. This is kind of powerful. This is so contrary to anything that people will ever tell you. People's life is all about acquiring things. Right? We acquire not only the physical stuff, it's about acquiring a sense of self, a sense of who we are, a social status, an academic status, relationships. Everything almost is about acquiring stuff. Almost everything in our lives is about that. And so it's so contrary to the way we look at things as a Buddhist, the way the Buddha looked at things. All that acquisition, whatever it is, on the mental level or on the physical level, leads to suffering. Right? It's a very radical statement when you think about it. It's very hard to kind of take it on board fully. And of course, you probably can't. It's very difficult. You have to be an Arya to do that. But you can gradually start to unwind this, gradually. And you can start to walk up the ladder of acquisition. Instead of acquiring all the core stuff that you know is going to be problematic, you can start acquiring some of the more refined things, right? Do a bit more, acquire sila. Become one who owns your virtue, owns a beautiful character. That is already a much better type of ownership than the ownership of all the things in the world. So become, have it a little bit of, it's okay to have a little bit of pride about your being a good person, right? You're doing the right thing in the world. It's okay to have a little bit of a pride of that. We cannot avoid having some degree of pride anyway. So because of that, make sure you are pride, proud about things that actually work, that actually get you somewhere. So it's okay. And then you acquire that. That becomes your acquisition. And you guard that. And you take it further. You develop your mind as well. And you become someone who develops a beautiful mind in your life. This is a beautiful mind. And it feels so pleasant. And one of the things that you realize is that as you acquire something more refined, something more beautiful, there is less craving associated with that. The really coarse and powerful cravings are quite low. And they are not very... You can feel that there's something very wrong with them. They have this kind of hunger inside, this hole inside. You feel like something is missing inside you in a very powerful way. As you climb this ladder of things, that hole inside starts to diminish and becomes less. The craving is less. You feel more satisfied and content with life as a consequence. And one day, when you get into a really deep state of samadhi, that sense of lack, that sense of not being fulfilled, is completely gone. Wow! Completely fulfilled, right? What an amazing thing that is, when you feel completely fulfilled, no more craving, nothing to search for. The present moment is all that matters. If you are completely fulfilled, you don't want to go anywhere in the future or the past. You don't want to search for anything else. Wow, what a wonderful thing that is. And then that becomes, in a sense, your acquisition, right? This perfect moment right now. And that becomes then part of the problem, because then you try to acquire that, and then that leads you slightly astray. But at the very least, you're heading in the right direction. You're acquiring things that are more and more refined, until one day you can see through the whole thing of acquisition and abandon all of it, and it's all gone. And that, of course, is the day when you become a stream enter, and you think, whoa, it's all just nonsense. It's much better to abandon all that. And then you feel vastly much better as a consequence. People think that being a stream enter must be so much suffering, have to give up everything. No, it is a lot of happiness, obviously. And this is the kind of the paradox here. So, that's how it works. If you nurture acquisitions, you are nurturing suffering. So don't nurture those acquisitions. Move up the ladder of more refined acquisitions. And as you do that, you are denurturing it. Suffering. What is the word for denurturing? Starving, perhaps. Starving suffering, right? Taking away the fuel, taking away the nutriment for suffering. You're starving it of fuel, and gradually it declines. Your future rebirths are becoming fewer and fewer, and they're becoming more and more refined, what is left there. So, because of all that, when you are nurturing suffering, you have a problem. That's what it says here. Okay, then the Buddha goes on to say, whatever ascetics and Brahmins in the future will regard that in the world with a pleasant and agreeable nature, as permanent, as happiness, as self, as healthy, as secure, they will nurture craving. In nurturing craving, they will nurture acquisition or ownership. In nurturing ownership, they will nurture suffering. In nurturing suffering, they will not be freed from birth, from old age, from death. They will not be freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. They will not be freed from suffering, I say. Whatever ascetics and Brahmins at present regard that in the world with a pleasant and agreeable nature, as permanent, as happiness, as self, as healthy, as secure, they are nurturing craving. In nurturing craving, they are nurturing acquisition. In nurturing acquisition, they are nurturing suffering. In nurturing suffering, they are not freed from birth, old age, and death. They are not freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. They are not freed from suffering, I say. So everybody, same problem all around. Suppose, monks, there was a bronze cup of a beverage having a fine color, aroma, and taste, but it was mixed with poison. Then a man would come along, oppressed and afflicted by the heat, tired, parched, and thirsty. They would tell him, good man, this beverage in the bronze cup has a fine color, aroma, and taste, but it is mixed with poison. drink it if you like. If you drink it, it will gratify you with its color, aroma, and taste. But by drinking it, you will meet death or deadly suffering. Suddenly, without reflecting, he would drink the beverage. He would not reject it, and thereby he would meet death or deadly suffering. So this, again, how the Buddha always underlines what he says by similes. And so it's always good to reflect a little bit on these similes, because then they drive home the point from a different angle than the kind of purely declarative prose, or not the kind of ordinary prose thing. And so here you have this bronze cup. I think the idea of a bronze cup, it's probably some kind of high status cup, right? I think that's the idea. Very expensive, nice cup, which has some very beautiful beverage inside, which looks nice and all that kind of thing. But it's mixed with poison, right? So this is how the Buddha talks about these agreeable and delightful things in the world, right? They look so nice. They are so beautiful. It is so wonderful to kind of indulge in all of these things in the world. Well, what can be the problem? Why not? Why can't we combine the spiritual life with indulging in sensual pleasures at the same time? Surely there is no contradiction, right? That's how many people think. And of course, the point here is not to enter upon some kind of super ascetic practice. The point is just to remind ourselves that there is a problem here, and then gradually the mind can emerge from that if we remind ourselves. It's important not to take these things in the wrong way and reject these things with force out of some kind of aversion or something like that. That's not really the point. But the point is that if you understand it, the mind will naturally disincline a little bit from that. And then when it disinclines from that, you find that it actually helps your meditation practice. Right? So once you distance yourself a little bit from those things, because you start to understand the problem, your mind inclines more to meditation already. This is what really is about. It's a kind of a natural process. Don't think of it as something forceful that you have to do. So it looks so beautiful, right? But it's mixed with poison. And the poison that is mixed with is the poison that leads you on to future lives endlessly. Now going up, now going down, now suffering a lot, now being a bit more happy. This eternal wandering on, pointless, aimless wandering, which doesn't get you anywhere. So this is the thing. And then this man comes along, right? He is oppressed and afflicted. Man or a woman, or anybody for that matter. Afflicted by the heat, tired, parched and thirsty. And this is the feeling that we have wandering around in samsara. We are thirsty. We crave for things, right? The word tanha, actually a strong form of craving. I must have something to drink now. I'm thirsty. This is what craving really is. It's kind of a thirst inside of us. And this is how we lead our lives. We're wandering around. We are suffering. We are parched, right? We feel hot. Craving makes you feel hot. And you are thirsty, and you're looking for some kind of satisfaction, wandering around in the world. And then, while you're doing this, you come across this bronze beverage having all these nice things. And you think, should I drink this or should I not? That is the question. And then they would tell him. And of course, the person who tells him is the Buddha. He says, good man, okay, so here are, all of this nice beverage, it looks very nice, but there are some problems with that. It is poisonous. It's going to lead to suffering for you. This is what the Buddha is saying here, right? There's a drawback which cannot be seen straight away. You don't know that this leads to problems in the future. It's actually quite difficult to see these things. You need to kind of gradually train yourself. But if you have some confidence in the Buddha, if you believe what this man says, then you start on that path to unravel that problem, which is caused by this indulging in these agreeable and pleasant things. So this is a simile for the Buddha, this particular, or a metaphor for the Buddha, this man who says these things. So, and then you meet death or deadly suffering as a consequence. And then suddenly, without reflecting, right? Without reflecting is the opposite of yoniso manasikara. Yoniso manasikara is this beautiful Pali phrase which means wise reflection. And whenever you reflect wisely, you are heading in the right direction. Whenever you have ayoniso manasikara, it means unwise reflection. Whenever you do that, you're heading in the wrong direction here. So we try to have as much yoniso manasikara as possible here. So suddenly, without reflecting, right? We often like that in the world. Oh, I'm fed up with this spiritual path. I don't want to do it anymore. I'm not sure if I really have any confidence in this anyway. It doesn't work, you know. It doesn't give the results it's supposed to do. Okay, I'm just going to go out and indulge myself. I've had enough of this. And this can sometimes happen. You know, you take the spiritual path up in the wrong way. You force yourself too hard, you know. You do too many ascetic practices. This happens sometimes in monastic life, monks doing all these kind of ascetic practices over the top, and then they end up disrobing because you can't really sustain it in the long run. Instead of doing the middle path, they have taken up an extreme which is actually not really possible to sustain in the long run. So you suddenly just reject it, can't reflect anymore, had enough, you drink it, and because you do that, you end up with those problems that the Buddha was talking about. And then the Buddha repeats the statement from before. So too, whatever ascetics and Brahmins in the past, future and present, regard that in the world with a pleasant and agreeable nature as permanent, as happiness, as self, as healthy, as secure. They are nurturing craving. In nurturing craving, etc., they are not freed from suffering, I say. But bhikkhus, whatever ascetics and Brahmins in the past regarded that in the world with a pleasant and agreeable nature as impermanent, as unreliable, as uncertain, as not really there for you when you want it, as suffering, as non-self, as a disease, as dangerous. Bhaya means like dangerous, fearful perhaps as well, because fear and danger often go together, but it's dangerous stuff. They abandon craving because you understand you can't control these things. Why are you craving for all this stuff you can't control? Why are you craving for all of these things that will just lead to suffering in the future? And then they abandon craving, they abandon a sense of ownership. Remember, when we talk about abandoning ownership, it's a psychological state. It is not that you may still own stuff, right? Even if you're an arahant, you still have a robe. So in a kind of legal sense, you are still the owner of that robe, but you don't have that psychological sense of ownership. This is what this is about. So important to be clear about that, perhaps. So in abandoning that sense of ownership, you abandon suffering, because there is no basis anymore for being reborn in the future. So in abandoning suffering, they are freed from birth, right? Future lives, old age and death. They are freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure and despair. They are freed from suffering, I say. Whatever ascetics and Brahmins in the future, in the same way, whatever ascetics and Brahmins in the present, regard that in the world with a pleasant and agreeable nature as impermanent, as suffering, as non-self, as a disease, as dangerous. They are abandoning craving. In abandoning craving, they are freed from suffering, I say. Suppose, monks, there was a bronze cup of a beverage having a fine color, aroma, and taste, but it was mixed with poison. Then a man would come along, oppressed and afflicted by the heat, tired, parched and thirsty. They would tell him, "Good man, this beverage in the cup has a fine color, aroma and taste, but it is mixed with poison. Drink it if you wish. If you drink it, it will gratify you with its color, aroma and taste. But by drinking it, you will meet death and deadly suffering." Then the man would think, "I can quench my thirst with water, whey, porridge or soup, but I should not drink that beverage, since to do so would lead to my harm and suffering for a long time." Having reflected, he would not drink the beverage, but would reject it, and thereby he would not meet death or deadly suffering. So here we have the same idea again. The person who is oppressed by all the things in the world has a need to find something to quench his thirst, to satisfy his craving, and he finds an alternative way. Instead of taking the poisonous route with that delicious, nice, sensual thing, he takes something which is much more neutral, just ordinary water, right? Just enough to satisfy the worst kind of craving. And of course, part of this, of taking the ordinary water, part of that is and the whey and the porridge and the soup, these are more neutral things that are not very delightful, but they are enough to keep you going. And then you continue your practice through the meditation practice instead, by abandoning craving completely, and then finding that fulfillment inside that you wanted to find, that craving wanted to find for you all along, but that it can never actually fulfill. Craving is like this liar, right? It's one of the great ways of regarding craving. It's a liar. Craving tells you, if I do this, I will be satisfied. If I go there, I will be happy. And if you watch carefully, you will see after a while that craving never tells you the truth. Craving distorts the reality. Craving says one thing, the reality is something else. So because that craving says you will be satisfied, no, the only way of satisfying craving is actually to abandon it in a completely different way and finding that satisfaction inside of you instead. And then you are no longer drinking that poison. You abandon the poison. And when you abandon the poison, you get good results instead. So too, because whatever ascetics and Brahmins in the past, in the future, and at present regard that in the world with a pleasant and agreeable nature as impermanent, as suffering, as non-self, as a disease, as dangerous, they are abandoning craving. In abandoning craving, they are abandoning ownership. In abandoning ownership, they are abandoning suffering, old age, and death. And they are freed from suffering, I say. Okay, so that is a slightly different take on dependent origination for you. This is actually quite a beautiful sutta, and it shows you how, I think, quite nicely how these things work in practice. It's more, you get some idea how to deal with this on a personal level. Does anybody have any questions? Is it fully grasped, fully understood? sometimes you don't know exactly what to ask, right? You hear something and you're kind of scratching your head. But of course, a lot of the understanding is just gradually allowing it to become deeper and deeper and seeing these things. Anybody want to ask? Chris? Yeah. Okay, so I can read. Okay. So how does this gel with the teaching of not being scared with the bliss of meditation and happiness of meditation? Because if you are if you're not scared, you will presumably crave, and then you will become an owner, and then you will kind of lead to rebirth. That's basically what you're suggesting, right? Well, the way it gels is that this is what I was talking about: the ladder of acquisition, right? The degrees of acquisition, your ownership. Actually, you have to own things. This is the problem of the sense of self. The sense of self must own stuff. That's what it does. There are things, you know, you identify with certain things, and those things you identify with, either they are you, or you own those things to some extent. This is starting out with the five khandhas. So to some extent, we have to own things in the world. And because we have to own things, what is important is we choose the right things to own. So you start off by, instead of being an immoral person, owning your immorality, you start becoming a nice guy, and you own that kindness instead, right? This is kind of the first thing here. And you do so gradually, you own more and more beautiful and more refined things. And when you come to things like the bliss of meditation, it's already incredibly refined. Yes, there is still some degree of ownership there, but at this point, it is a different type of ownership entirely. It is so much more refined than ordinary ownership in the world. It's almost the ownership itself starts to kind of almost peter out and becomes almost nothing. Yeah? The most dangerous things with meditation practice is not so much the immediate ownership of that state of mind. It's more the problem that comes afterwards when you lose it and you want to get it back again. That is a big hindrance. Because that's often distorted. You think you remember what it was, but you don't actually remember it properly. You've forgotten the path in there, all that kind of stuff. That is one of the biggest problems for meditation practice. So it is a ladder, right? We have to own stuff. So don't be too worried about it. Just move in the right direction, I think. Yeah. Yes, Annie. Yeah. So I just repeat for those people who are listening, on the recording or whatever, that this word acquisition has always been a bit difficult, and I agree with you. I always found it a bit strange, and this is one of the reasons why I suggested when I was discussing this. Sometimes I discussed this thing with translators, and I suggested other renderings of this, and I agree with you. And ownership, I think ownership is not as I like that word because it is obviously implied in acquisition, the idea of ownership. It is not exactly the same meaning because one is the thing, the other one is your attitude towards it. It's a slightly different meaning. But one of the ways is you can just call it possessions, right? That's what a simple way of looking at it. Your possessions in the world, acquisitions, is a similar kind of idea. So the things that we can control are precisely the things that we want to possess and that we think we possess in the world. Yeah. Upadi. Yeah. I think with so many things, the Buddha uses the ordinary words that are available to him. And I think the root meaning of these are the actual possessions in the world, right? Your house, your gold and silver or whatever it is. I don't know if you have a pile of gold and silver in your house, but sometimes you have these things in the sutta. It's quite funny. But so the ordinary possessions in the world. But I think in the Buddhist idea is that you expand that because the Buddha, obviously, because of his more profound understanding of reality and because he had to use existing vocabulary, he often had to expand that vocabulary to include new ideas and new meanings. So for him, that ownership also includes all of what we are, right? Ownership of this body, of this mind, all of this kind of stuff as well. Yeah. Okay, anybody else would like to ask anything? John? No? Okay. I think everybody seems to be happy. So, yeah, please bring it up. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so this is from Russ. From Hawaii, Russ. I know Russ from online. So hi, Russ. How are you? Nice to have you here. And he asked the following question: how should a layperson who is unable to ordain in this lifetime practice so that in the next rebirth he or she can continue the practice that leads to liberation? Thank you, Bhante. Well, you do exactly the same thing, right? You do exactly those things that, you know, lead in the right direction. The Noble Eightfold Path is what it comes down to. The more firm your foundation is in this lifetime, the more likely it is that you will continue practicing the right way in the future. I always like this one sutta, which I thought was quite interesting. When I read it a while ago, I think actually it was John Treasurer who brought this sutta to my attention at one stage. And this sutta was that exactly this kind of question came up. How can I ensure that I will kind of continue my practice in the future? And the answer was that what you should do is get a good understanding of the Buddhist teachings. This is kind of the main thing here. Really understand what these teachings are about. Right? And you have to be very careful here because the understanding of the Buddha's teachings, they can be delivered in many different ways. They can be delivered by a teacher. Right? Any teacher. People often take ordinary people in the world as their teachers of whatever. Or they can come from the Buddha. Now, if you hear a teaching from some teacher somewhere, it's often idiosyncratic, it's delivered in a certain way, and it's not always clear exactly how it gels with the Buddha's teachings. And then when you get reborn in a future life, you may not be able to recognize that as easily as the Buddha's teachings. So one of the best ways to ensure this is actually to make sure you have a very clear understanding of the real teachings of the Buddha. And then when you get reborn in the future life, and it's very nice in the sutta, it says you get reborn in this deva realm, right, together with all these gods, you have a good time, you're enjoying yourself, and then one day this other god comes along and he's reciting something, right? And you think, wait a minute, I know that, right? You're kind of enjoying yourself in the godly realm, and somebody reciting some verse or something, and you think, well, I've heard this before somewhere. And then you gradually remember, actually, this is what I learned as a human being, right? I was down there listening to, reading the suttas, you know, for myself, and this is what I was hearing. And then you get kind of, you get drawn back into the Dhamma, even as a deva, right? Because you remember what actually life really, you remember the truth of these sayings or whatever, huh? So this is the idea. So you do your very best, but of course your ability to recognize the Dhamma and to continue practicing also depends on your state of mind. So the more developed your mind is in this life, the more ability you will have to take them on board and continue in the future life. So whatever you do in this life, the further down the path you can go, the more you can do to get there, the better it is. So just do all the good things, right? Remember, at the end of the day, it's all about purifying yourself, purifying the mind, removing the hindrances, removing all those things that block you from seeing things in the right way. The Visuddhimagga, the Noble Eightfold Path, not the book, the Noble Eightfold Path, that is what it's all about. So look inside of yourself. What are the defilements? What are the problems in your life? What are the things that you have to get rid of? And then gradually move in that direction. Go on retreat every now and again. Check out your mind state. Check out your meditation. Is it improving over time or is it not? And if it isn't, ask yourself why. You have to be honest with yourself if there are problems. Where are those problems? And with that sense of honesty, integrity, goodwill towards yourself and others, and a sense of optimism, because you have these amazing teachings to rely on, you are bound to make progress on the path. So I'm sure you make lots of progress in this life, Russ, because I think you have all the right attitudes. So just keep at it. Don't give up. And if you have any difficult problems, just ask again here next time or whenever it is. Okay. Then we have Lauren from the U.S., and she asks the following: how can one use these teachings to help independently deal with personal difficulties such as poverty, unfairness, and unfulfilled dreams? Okay, to help independently deal with all of these things such as poverty, unfairness, and unfulfilled dreams. Okay, well, I think these teachings are great. They are great and very useful regardless of your personal circumstances, because they will give your life a sense of meaning. The most important thing in life is to have a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose, that you're aiming for something useful, that you're going in the right direction. A lot of people, I think, if you are too materialistic, you lose that sense of meaning in life. And this is the worst thing that can happen to you, any human being. Sometimes you can have lots of money and possessions, not live in poverty at all, and yet not really have much sense of meaning in life. Much better to be a poor person and have a sense of meaning than to be a wealthy person and live a life which is meaningless and pointless. So it will give you meaning in life, and I think this is one of the most powerful and important things about this Buddhist path. And this is why, you know, you may feel that you are living in poverty in a sense, but as a Buddhist monk, I am actually, you know, on all the kind of scales of poverty, I kind of rank at the very bottom, right? Basically, that's the truth. But it doesn't bother me at all. I don't care about that. I'm actually quite happy to live the way I do, because I live a very rich life in so many other ways. I don't care if I am material. I don't really own anything. You go to the monastery in Serpentine, I live in a little hut. I don't even own that hut, right? I kind of own these robes, sort of, and a few books in my room. And I'll be happy to give those books away anytime if I'm going somewhere else. And it's great. I don't really need anything in life. So poverty doesn't have to be a problem. It's how you deal with that poverty is much more important. So if I were you, I wouldn't worry too much about that. Just use these teachings to create a meaning in your life. And you find meaning somewhere else. And you find something very, very powerful inside of you. And such things as unfairness and unfulfilled dreams. Well, again, you know, these are the things in life that sometimes that you have to deal with. And sometimes it is difficult to get away from that. It's difficult to find any solution to that. There aren't any kind of magic bullets or anything like that that will get you away from those things. Sometimes perhaps there are solutions. Sometimes you can move somewhere else, or you can get another job, or whatever else, or you can find new friends, or I don't know what. There might be some temporary solutions. But usually the solutions tend to arise in time to these things. And especially if you live a good life and you try to be kind to others, regardless of how they treat you, remember that other people, they are a victim of their own circumstances. Remember to look at other people in the right way. Often looking at people in the right way makes an enormous difference in your ability to deal with the world. And if you remember that other people, circumstances, that the way they are is because of the way they have been conditioned in life, you can't really blame them anymore, right? There's no point in blaming them because they are the way they are, because that's how they have been conditioned and how they have been created into this world. They can't be any different, probably. And no doubt, many of these people who are unfair and unreasonable, they actually want to be kind. They want to do the right thing, but they're, despite the fact that they want to do so, they are incapable of doing that because their conditioning is so strong. And when you remember that, you can almost have a sense of compassion for these people. And this is why the teachings of non-self are so powerful, because they take out that sense of a person being bad towards somebody else because they want to be bad. No, they don't really want to be bad. So remember this non-self thing. It's not personal. It's never personal, these things. They are just the meetings of two people happening. Two different conditioned entities meeting, and then there is a clash as a consequence. But there is no there's no need to blame them, or to don't blame yourself either. Don't blame anybody. Just sit back and think, well, what can I do about this? At the very least, you have the Buddhist teachings, and you practice those wisely and rightly, the solutions will tend to come over time. And so sometimes you just have to wait for the solution, and the solution will arrive. So that is an unfulfilled dream. Remember that a lot of those dreams anyway, you know, they're not necessarily all that interesting. You know, if I think of my own life, when I was young, I had all these kind of ideas of what I should be and what I should do. And now I think, what a load of nonsense that was anyway. Who cares about all those things, right? So don't worry about that, because actually all your dreams will be fulfilled if you practice the spiritual path well. That is when your dreams will be, in fact, much more than your dreams will be fulfilled, because you will fulfill things that you never knew could be fulfilled in the first place. That is a real deal, right? When actually you go beyond your dreams and you go to something even more profound and beautiful. So that is much better. So try to look at it that way. Those dreams are often not all that interesting in the first place. Okay. Last question for today. This is from Michelle in South Australia. And she asks, once we see things that we have picked up and owned that are not leading to happiness, how do we become untangled from them? I feel like I am disgusted by many things I once strove for. Okay. Good. That's a good sign that you are a little bit kind of, because you can maybe see the danger in those things, right? And because you can see the danger in those things, you become a little bit, averse. Don't want to touch those things. That's a good thing. So that's not necessarily bad. But be careful not to go too fast. Don't be too idealistic. Don't think that you can kind of travel this path faster than you actually can. Allow things to come naturally. And the reason why These teachings are given by the Buddha. It's not so that you reject everything you own out of hand. It's more a teaching to be thought about. And as you think about it, that rejection happens automatically inside of you. You start to feel less attached. It's not something that you do. You don't force that to happen. It happens as a consequence of your reflection. And then it is a good way of detaching. But if you think, oh no, the Buddha said I must reject all this, so you kind of throw it all out of the window or whatever, it's not going to work. It doesn't work like that. It has to come from a real felt experience inside of you. So this is the first thing. The second thing is that these teachings, which are really teachings about impermanence and the unreliability of things, they must always be balanced with practicing in the right way in the world. Doing the things of kindness, being kind, being a good person, thinking kind thoughts, being generous, being peaceful, and do all those right things, then you find something else that you can rely on in life. Because those things will be a reliable source of happiness if you do them in the right way. They won't always be there, but you will always be able to come back to those things. So when you get, on the one hand, you remind yourself of the impermanence and the danger and acquisitions. On the other hand, you build up happiness somewhere else. When you have that beautiful balance of these two things going together, they support each other. And when they support each other, you're lifting yourself up and you're heading in the right way. So be careful. Sometimes people get too idealistic about the spiritual path. Right? Yeah, okay, I'm going to follow the Buddha's word straight away. And they think that kind of, you know, that you can become an arahant overnight. You can't become an arahant overnight. It takes many nights. So, so that is... So anyway, I hope that helps for you. Anybody else want to say anything here while you are here? While we are here? While you have the chance? Everybody content? Yeah? Great. Okay, let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.